Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, October 15th, hello everybody, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg.
Kevin, I was trying to think of the worst thing that ever happened to me as a kid while I was playing outside and no adults were watching. So I was thinking back, and then I actually touched my forehead and I remembered I have a little knot on the top of my forehead still.
Okay.
From something that happened when I was like 6 or 7 years old. I was playing football on a playground and I was looking up trying to catch a pass and I ran into this big cement tunnel thing flush with my head. I mean, blood everywhere.
If it only was your dad was there to
exactly.
Put his arm out and save
so
you.
So I will say for my parents' sake, I was actually staying with my aunt and uncle that weekend, so it's their fault. And but the whole point being that this is the worst thing that ever happened to me in all of the hours of unstructured, unsupervised play. And I actually remember it fondly now. It's like a fun story. I like to tell it. I still have this little knot on my forehead. And I say all this to set up the show today, which is about whether or not parents need to allow more of their kids to run into cement tubes. And I'm being light about this, but to do more unstructured, unsupervised play so that they can establish their independence. Basically, hover a little less, back off a little more. We have a great guest today who started a whole movement around this idea. Her name's Lenore Scanese. And we're asking you to contribute, as always. How do you strike a balance between giving your children or grandchildren independence and keeping them safe? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, tell us your most gruesome childhood injuries. No, I'm just kidding. Drop your comments in the chat.
Yeah, really looking forward to this conversation today. We're both parents. We're actively trying to figure this out. It's been, you know, stirring up all these conversations on the team of what it was like for us growing up, what was different, what's changed. So we've got this great guest. Really looking forward to that. But first, our trio of local news stories.
Start us off, Kevin.
Yeah, number one, okay, what Philly attorneys really think of Philly judges. Okay, so this November's election will include basically a retention election for these common pleas court and municipal court judges in Philadelphia.
Snooze, I'm already falling asleep, Kevin.
Right. So if you're a Philly voter and you go to the polls, you're going to have to pick yes or no, keep them or dump them. Most people don't know, obviously, how this court works. So what I do and what a lot of people do is rely on the Philadelphia Bar Association. Do they recommend these judges or not? So typically those things come out and you can look at those.
Yes,
you can
no,
read a little bit about it. What we got today was this really fascinating behind the scenes look into how that decision gets made. And it includes anonymous commentary from the attorneys that deal with these judges every day. And Samantha Malamed in the Inquirer did this great piece, and she was able to get all these confidential survey responses and, you know, put out there what we found. And the candor is pretty remarkable,
Avi.
It's amazing. Right? From the good, right? So one judge is called a wonderful, caring, intelligent jurist, a true public servant, to the bad, where we have one judge being called cruel and condescending, another incapable of making an appropriate decision expeditiously. Another review says, quote, I genuinely do not think she knows the law. So just amazing insight into what at least the Bar Association is considering as they make these judgments. What did you make of this, Avi?
I mean, first of all, it was a great piece of reporting by Sam. She got this leaked document, basically, and you get a sense of what these lawyers really think. And it's not often pretty. And in addition, she got like the percentage of lawyers who said X judge should be retained. So for some judges, you know, 96% of lawyers said they should be retained. For the lowest one, it was 25%. I mean, that's amazing that there's a judge sitting there making decisions about people's future, and only a quarter of the lawyers polled by the bar think that person should be a judge.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing, right? It stirs up a lot of thoughts for me, one of which is that we think of the legal system as a set of laws. And yes, it is that. But it's a set of laws being implemented by a group of people. And I just cannot imagine if it was me or a loved one going before that 25% judge and having their future determined. Yes, you can appeal, but appeals take a while. It's just it twists your stomach to think that's possible and that this person almost certainly will be a judge far into the future.
Yeah, so it's a reminder, of course, we have an election coming up, and they're, you know, not big races per se in Pennsylvania, but this is one of them that does matter, has a lot of influence in how things work in the city, and I definitely recommend...
But the judges always get retained.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. Right? I recommend reading the Bar Association's recommendations. I recommend this story in the Inquirer, but the kind of kicker is, especially for these retention elections, what the bar says almost doesn't matter because everybody just votes yes.
Yep.
Story number two.
Story number two. No one voting yes here. A lot of no voting floating around this story. Lower Merion Township, just west of Philadelphia, is on the verge, Kevin, of banning gas-powered leaf blowers. A proposed rule would phase out the foliage fighters, culminating in an all-out ban by 2029. At a recent township meeting, the comment period on this proposal lasted 3 hours, according to the Inquirer, which gives you a sense of how much blowback these gas-powered blowers have inspired in some communities. Folks don't like the noise, the pollution, etc. Landscapers say, hey, we need them. Otherwise, our business is going to suffer because the electric-powered blowers just don't get the job done.
Yeah, we're both city residents, so I feel like this is less of a thing in our neck of the woods.
Well, I was going to ask you, because you're Northwest.
I'm Northwest.
And I'm South Philly, you don't need a leaf. If you need a leaf blower in South Philadelphia, you need to get a life.
Here's where I'm at on it personally is my wife doesn't even let me rake the leaves because she's like, the leaves need to break down and give nutrients to the earth.
I was legitimately going to ask you that because I've never, as an adult, owned a lawn. Okay, I've never owned a lawn as an adult, never done lawn care. Why do people rake the leaves? I don't quite get it.
Looks pretty. A nice but monoculture
I think leaves
of
look
green
pretty
grass.
Too.
Well, and then they're dead and they get all, you know, crackly and rained on and snowed on. Right?
So it's all looks. It's got nothing to do with lawn care?
100% as far as I understand it. Yeah. And a horticulturalist might call in and tell us differently.
Yeah, I was just like, and I remember raking leaves as a kid. We didn't have a blower. I raked them. And I thought back. I was like, wait, why did we do that? So it's just for aesthetics.
It's aesthetics, yeah. I mean, people's lawn is a point of pride in this country. Have you seen King of the Hill, Avi?
Oh, wait. Our producer, Debbie, says the leaves kill the grass when they sit wet on it.
Okay
so it might have something to do with the grass, which grass, by the way, is well, we could get into a whole conversation about that. But there's a lot of people out there who feel like we should have less grass and we should have lawns with different types of plants. Anyways, but anyway, I'm always fascinated by how much debate this inspires, this particular issue, because we've done shows on it and the phone lines get like jammed up.
Right.
Like the Schuylkill Expressway as soon as we talk about this topic.
So we'll have to watch what happens in Lower Merion.
All right, third story. I love this one, Kevin.
Okay, Love Park. You remember the old Love Park, Avi?
I remember it.
Okay, it was a mecca for skateboarders, and now it's being recreated literally from some of the original pieces in Sweden.
That's crazy.
Right? So it just take us back in time, right? It's the 80s, it's the 90s. If you're a skateboarder, Love Park in Philadelphia, John F. Kennedy Plaza, becomes this, like, you know, place to be. The smooth granite, the ledges at the perfect height. And city leaders, of course, hate it. They don't like the fact that this plaza that they had envisioned being like the place where business people went and had lunch became taken
invaded by skateboarders.
And you know, mayors throughout the 90s into the 2000s waged war essentially on the skaters. And ultimately in 2016, they demolished the original plaza. They rebuilt it anew. And kind of the amazing thing is some of those skaters who grew up in the 80s and 90s building this convinced the city, let us have some of the old parts. Let's keep the scrap. They keep it in storage. And along comes this guy from Sweden who says, oh my God, I love what Philadelphia used to have. Let me rebuild it in Sweden where I'm trying to foster a skateboard culture.
Yeah.
Right. And literally also put it right in the middle of the downtown there in Malmo, Sweden.
Yeah. It's an amazing story. New York Times did a deep dive on this that just came out, and I recommend you read it. And it's a meditation on the old Love Park. And it's sort of symbolism within the skateboarding community of the 80s and 90s. And a little bit of a look at like why one society would reject this type of thing. Obviously, Philadelphia straight up demolished this place. Or they recreated it. And another society sort of wants it so bad that they're willing to go through these painstaking ends to recreate it. And it's a really interesting look about how societies look at skateboarding and things generally seen as dangerous or part of outlaw culture. So it's just worth a read. I will say, by the way, not all of the old Love Park remnants have ended up in Sweden. Some of them are actually scattered still around Philadelphia, various skate spots around the region. So some of that legacy has been preserved and is still here. But if you want the real thing, the whole recreation, you got to go to Sweden.
That's right. And what's really interesting is when they asked the guy in Sweden, how did this come about or why do you think there's difference? He pointed to something that touches our main conversation today. He's like, the culture there is just people able to do more things on their own. And especially the lawsuit culture just isn't there in Sweden.
He was saying there's lots of risk aversion.
Yeah.
Baked into the culture of America, and that's not quite the same way in Sweden. So they're much more likely to embrace this type of architecture, this type of landscape. Again, a great read in the New York Times. So again, transitioning into the big story today, how do you strike a balance between giving your children independence and keeping them safe? We're talking about free-range parenting today. Give us a call, 888-477-9499.
And we're back here with Studio 2. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. This is a good story for the next time you want to try to change someone's behavior by internet shaming them. I want you to consider the story of Lenore Skenazy, our guest today. So back in 2008, she wrote an article about letting her 9-year-old son ride the New York subway alone. And of course, this is the internet, so people went absolutely bonkers. But instead of backing down, Skenazy quadrupled down.
Yeah, and she helped create this entire movement around what she calls free-range parenting. Basically, the idea that kids need more independence and that parents need to back off a bit. She argues that we inflate the risks of unsupervised outdoor time while underestimating the hazards of a childhood spent online or in tightly structured activities. So Lenore Skenazy, president of the Let Grow and author of Free Range Kids, welcome to Studio 2. So great to have you with us.
Hey, thank you guys. Happy to be here.
We are happy to have you, and we are happy to have our audience who are already starting to write in. We'd love to hear from you this hour. How do you strike a balance, you, talking about you, between giving your kids or your grandkids independence and keeping them safe? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, Lenore, just curious if you can kind of take us through that initial column that you wrote in 2008 that kind of skyrocketed you into notoriety and up to today. Like, how did that come about? What's your story on how you got where you are now?
Oh, thank you for asking. So, oh my God, it's so long ago, but in 2008, when our younger son was 9, he started asking me and my husband if we would take him someplace he'd never been before here in New York City where we live and let him find his own way home by subway. So long story short is one day I did that. I took him to Bloomingdale's where he hadn't been. Who shops with a kid at Bloomingdale's? Really? And I left him there because, I told him it was the day. It wasn't like he was like, wait, where'd my mom go? He knew that I was going to leave him there. And also Bloomingdale's has its own subway stop, la-di-da. So all you have to do is go downstairs and you're on the subway. And then you had to take the subway down, I don't know, like 4 stops, and then take a bus across town, which is not very far, but it's really slow. And when he came into the apartment, he was levitating because he had done something on his own that he believed he was ready to do and that we believed he was ready to do. And it wasn't a publicity stunt and it wasn't even to prove anything. It was just something that he wanted to do. So I didn't write about it for like 2 months, but I was a newspaper columnist back then. And maybe your listeners remember what newspapers were. And it's like a giant blog on paper.
Yeah, just Bloomingdale's and newspapers alone. But we are dating the story just when those two touch points. Yeah.
And then I got my carriage and hurried home to the post. Anyways, the point is I finally wrote a column, Why I Let My 9-Year-Old Ride the Subway Alone. And 2 days later, I was on the Today Show, MSNBC, Fox News, and NPR. Fox News and NPR, it sort of hit every button. And I was left defending myself. And I started a blog that weekend because you don't really get to defend yourself when you're in the hot seat. And so I started the Free Range Kids blog to say our kids are smarter and safer and stronger than our very, very frightened culture gives them credit for. And that people should believe me because I'm not a heedless mom. I believe in helmets and car seats and seat belts and mouth guards. And it's not like I don't care about safety, but I was a reporter back then, just wandering around the city all the time. And so I really got to know what was reality versus excessive fear. And the fear had just gone off the charts in terms of ever letting our kids do anything on their own. And then one last thing.
Yeah, sure.
About 8 years ago, Jonathan Haidt, who recently wrote the book The Anxious Generation, and a man named Daniel Schuckman, who was chairman of FIRE, which fights for free speech on campus, and Peter Gray, who's a psychologist who studies the importance of free play, and I got together and we started Let Grow, which if you're watching on YouTube, there's the word let grow, two words. And that is just trying to do the sort of the mission of Free Range Kids some more, which is to make it easy, normal, and legal to give kids back some independence because it has just become so unheard of, I would say,
What's
these
the
days.
evidence that indeed it's become so unheard of? I feel like this is a squishy thing. It might be a little bit hard to track, but I know there's some data out
I
there,
know.
right? So how do we know that kids are spending less time outdoors among themselves without adults?
It's not so squishy to me since I spend every day staring at these facts. The majority of kids, when I was growing up, and maybe even when you were growing up, walked to school. Now it's about 11%. We just did a Harris poll. We asked kids 8 to 12, what are you allowed to do on your own? And the majority had rarely or never walked around their own neighborhood without an adult. The majority said they were never allowed to be in public. And by public, we said like a store or like out, outside or a park. The majority said they're never allowed to be in public without an adult. The majority, a slim majority, but a majority had never been to another aisle at the grocery store without an adult. So those are radical things. Sometimes when I quote despairingly, what has changed, I quote the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a white paper a couple of years ago, and it suggested that nobody under age 10 should ever be a pedestrian on their own without an adult. And this week I'm dealing with a mom in Michigan who wants her son, who's 7, to be able to walk home the four houses in suburban Michigan from the bus stop to her house. And the school will not let that happen. She must be there to walk him home. So these are, I mean, I'll quit throwing these numbers and statistics and ideas at you and ask you, does that strike you as evidence?
Yeah, it certainly sounds different than I think I know I grew up. I'm curious, since you've thought about this and written about this and read about this for so long, if you're pinpointing what changed. We know it's not the data that suggests that there's a billion kids being kidnapped. So what
No.
actually changed?
The data does not suggest that a billion kids are being kidnapped, but the Harris poll that we also did asked parents if there's two kids age 10 playing together at the park, what's likely to happen? And 50% said they're likely to be kidnapped.
Wait,
That's
what? F
not.
five zero?
I know, please. I want you to be stunned. Like, huh?
Wait, no,
Really?
I thought you were like, I thought first I thought I misheard the number. 50%.
50% think they're likely to be kidnapped. Two 10-year-olds playing together at a park, which is why you never see kids in a park. I actually started thinking of parks as like set decoration for the suburbs. Like you don't really, nobody
Yeah,
uses
no one
that.
uses them. Yeah.
So how'd we get here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Because
So.
it was it. It's hard to imagine that all of a sudden people parenting is parenting. It's primal. It goes back for as long as humanity. So why would there be this
Right.
shift in how we view supervision?
Yeah. Parenting is parenting, but some of the things that we feel are primal are actually cultural. Like if you went to another country, they wouldn't say no child can't get off the bus four houses from their home and have to be walked home. Some of the things just become accretion. You mentioned right before this that we live in a litigious culture.
Yeah.
And so people start thinking like lawyers, well, could I be sued for this? Well, probably not. Well, will it happen? Well, probably not. But could I? Might it? Yes. Okay, forget it. We're not going to let it happen. But I'd say the biggest shift, and it's kind of boring because it's so obvious, is that the media just became so much more a part of our lives, really starting in the 80s, because that's when cable television came in with the 24-hour news cycle. And once you had 24 hours to fill with news, it felt like news was going on. Horrible things were going on
Yeah.
every single second of every single day. And there were a couple of very high-profile kidnappings. 1979 was a boy named Eitan here in New York. And then there was Adam Walsh in Florida. And after that, What was weird is that originally when Eitan was taken from a bus stop, I hate talking about this because now it sounds like, oh my God, kids are always being taken from bus stops. No wonder they don't let a kid get off at a bus stop. But in any event, when he was taken, the public's working assumption at that time, which is 79, was that he must have been taken by some lovelorn lady who wanted to raise him as her own. The whole idea of predators were still like owls and lions. We just weren't thinking about predators as prowling the streets as humans. Once that became part of the mix of what we think about, it became impossible not to think about because it is so salient, so horrifying, so heartbreaking, and so enraging that if you can tap into that, you can have all the attention you want. And of course, what are the media there for? They're there to get as many eyeballs as they can, not to teach and enlighten us. They're not WHYY. They
Yeah,
are the
thank you for
best of the
that, by the
media.
way.
That's right. Support your local station. I used to work at NPR. So it's the more eyeballs you get, the more money you can charge the advertisers. And so we really just got saturated with these stories. I think Law and Order is on like every second of every day somewhere in America. And they're the most gruesome, awful stories, and they sort of have the tinge of reality because sometimes the stories are sort of taken from the headlines, but then they're mashed up with our biggest fears and our Jungian worries. And we keep beating them up. And then that's certainly what sells in the movie theaters too. It's certainly what sells online and the internet. I just heard that true crime is the most popular genre of podcast. Have you heard that?
Oh, I believe that. I guess the other thing, though, that I think about, well, there's a couple things. One of which is that I try to think about what makes me most fearful as a parent and what I would feel most guilty about. And if my child spends too much time on the computer and sort of spread out over, let's say, 10 or 15 years, and then that somehow impacts their development, I'm really not going to see that or feel that. I could come up with other explanations for why their
You're
development
not
was
feeling it
impacted.
that instant.
Yeah, it's not the guilt. The guilt is not like acute. Whereas if I consciously make the decision to let my kid walk to the store and it ends in tragedy, I would never be able to forgive myself. And I think a
That's
big part of this
exactly right.
conversation is how can you push parents past that particular acute type of fear and fear of that guilt and that tragedy.
You've perfectly articulated the issue of the day. And I want to start by saying that when my mom let me walk to school, which obviously is back in the day, a lot of days ago, she did not think that way. She did not think, oh my God, my daughter's walking to school. What if I never see her again? I could never forgive myself. I'd have to kill my own self. There'd just be so much, my life would be unlivable. And therefore, I can't let her walk. And somehow that has become a common path for parents' minds to tread. And it feels innate. As you said, parenting has been going on forever. But I know it's not innate because I remember my mom, who quit her job to be at home with the kids, somehow was at home when the kids were outside. And she wasn't spending the whole time thinking, but if something happens, I could never forgive myself. So really, I like to think about where did that come from? I call it worst first thinking. You're coming up with the worst case scenario. My kid's walking to school, it's probably going to be fine, or walking to the store, it's probably going to be fine. But if it's not, and then you go to the worst case scenario, and then you proceed as if it's likely to happen. Well, because it could happen, therefore I can't let them go. The only thing I've seen that changes that cycle of thinking is reality. And the only way you can get reality into the mix is by taking action. And the action is actually letting your kid do something without you.
I'm wondering what you think about, a lot of this obviously is coming from a good place in people's hearts. And you noted,
Everything.
It's your generation who grew up this way, but a lot of your generation who then parented this way. So why did the latchkey kid become the helicopter parent? And I wonder if there's some truth in this idea that, like, maybe those kids growing up just felt disconnected from their families or their parents, and they didn't have great relationships, and they kind of went into parenthood thinking, I'm going to be way different. I'm going to be really connected with my kid's life. They're going to trust me. I'm going to trust them. And we're going to do this thing together. And that's ended up, being what you would maybe call too overbearing.
Well, I would never call it too overbearing okay. because, as I said, I think it's a culture that is foisting this upon us with the, you know, telling us that terrible things could happen and it'll be your fault, which I think is already very cruel, as if bad things never happen to good people. I mean, that's just so babyish to think that way. But I agree that we do want to have great relationships with our kids. And certainly, I would never say, don't be close with your kids or don't love them. But part of the, like developmentally for like the world of child development talks about this idea of secure attachment. So you want your kids to be securely attached to you. But that doesn't mean literally Velcroed yeah. to you. And that's what's changing. A secure attachment doesn't mean you spend every single second of every day with them. It means that they know you're there for them. They know that they trust, you know that they trust you and that they love you and they want the best for you. But that doesn't mean that they have to be at every soccer practice or that they have to, go over your grades with you every day after school. And yet, sort of accretion wise, that's what's become the norm. I mean, who was I talking to this morning? Oh, a recess lady, a recess activist, who said that she was older and her daughter has a bunch of kids. And the daughter spent the weekend at 13 different sporting activities. And one of the things that interests me about our culture is that the Surgeon General did a report in 2021 or something, saying that kids are more anxious and depressed than ever.
Sorry, I was just about to jump in and say we're getting some great comments here, some that agree with you, okay. some that are pushing back. Ruth okay. says parents are so overprotective of their kids that they are not getting the chance to figure things out for themselves. Within some limits, kids need more freedom and the ability to try things without mommy and daddy. But then Jonathan says we had been giving our 12-year-old more and more freedom, letting them hang out. And then last week we found out he had been vaping cannabis for a couple of months Ooh. When he shared it Ooh. With a friend. And he says, needless to say, it's going to take him a while to earn those privileges back as well as our trust. So some interesting comments there. We also want to make sure we give out the phone number again, 888-477-9499. We want to understand how parents are feeling about, the push and pull between independence and safety. I'm really curious to hear from grandparents out there, like if your view changed in how you raised your kids versus now how you think about your grandkids and how you experienced all this cultural change. We're hoping people give us a phone call, 1-888-477-9499.
So one thing we haven't touched on yet, Lenore, is what kids want. So I know kids will say in a survey, like, I would love more unstructured time, more unsupervised time. But the truth of the matter is that, 40 years ago, maybe the kid had access to a television, but certainly did not have access to the phone, didn't have access to the video games, all of these things designed to capture their attention and keep them inside. Right. So I just question, like, how much do kids really want to be outside hanging with other kids versus all these other things that they could be doing that are designed to keep them from doing exactly that?
So is this a softball question? Did you read my Atlantic article?
I did read the article and I got the Harris poll results here. But look, these polls I do think genuinely are tricky because telling people it's always hard to do poll questions. It's always hard to isolate.
We should tell people what the results were.
Go ahead. I'm letting you.
All right. So what was interesting is that it was the first Harris poll of kids asking how they spend their time and how they'd like to spend their time. And it was kids age 8 to 12. And they gave the kids, I don't know how this would have been misinterpreted by the kids, and the kids weren't doing it with their parents watching or for a grade or anything, but they were literally asked, how would you like to spend time with your friends? You could spend it just hanging out with your friends outside playing. You could spend time with your friends in an organized activity like soccer or ballet or chess or whatever, adult run activity. Or you could spend it online, either socializing, Snapchat, or playing video games. And the results were playing with my friends in real life was the number one desire, according to the kids who this was a Harris poll. I don't know how bad or biased it was, but I sort of trust them.
Well, it's not so much the poll. I think it's just like how accurately can you reflect your own feelings in a poll like that? Because I do, like, you could ask me, right? Do I want to be online? The answer is 100% no. Then somehow I've spent an hour looking at this stupid phone in my hand. I'm like, how did yeah, this happen too. Again? I do think there's a push and pull there, and I don't doubt that kids genuinely want to be outside, but I think it's tough. It's got to be tough to summon the energy to call up your friends, say let's meet somewhere when I could just easily sink an hour into that stinking phone.
Well, it's particularly tough if you're not allowed to play outside or, you know, go to the bus stop or be in public without an adult or walk around your neighborhood without an adult. You're never going to have that kind of time that you're dreaming of. I mean, what was so interesting to me was that the kids were longing for this, whether they've actually experienced it or not. I mean, maybe they saw it in, you know, an old episode of Sesame Street or something, kids playing outside, and they thought that looks fun because there's so little afforded to kids. So SelectGro is dedicated to trying to make this happen. And the easiest way that we've found to make free play happen with other kids, this old-fashioned way, it's not completely old-fashioned. It's you keep the schools open for mixed age, no phones, free play. So that you have, you know, people always talk about a third place, like Starbucks was a third place. It's not home, it's not work, it's a third place. School can be that third place where kids gather to play. And if you put out some, you know, some balls and some old cardboard boxes and a typewriter or something just fun and wacky to play with, they will play. And here you're sort of making a sanctuary where they can still have what they are instinctively longing for, which is this time with friends off their phones that they didn't have to organize, and it's a safe enough place that the parents trust it. This seems to me like the simplest way to recreate sort of a Stand By Me, E.T., whatever you want to, the Stranger Things childhood, without letting them go in, you know, letting them literally go, because they'll either go into a car to an organized activity or they'll go into their room with a phone.
Yeah.
So keep them where they already are, let them play. And very few schools have started doing this yet. I mean, maybe a couple hundred schools are doing what we call the Let Grow Play Club. And they do offer other things. They offer ukulele. They offer lacrosse. And like, why don't we just make free play one of the options for kids? Because free play turns out to be what they want. And it also is like so developmentally rich that how many psychologists do I talk to in a day who say the same thing? You know, kids, when they're playing, learn executive function and communication and compromise skills. It's like they do. So we got to give them this. And this is our suggestion as to how.
I'm sure there's some parents out there who might be being compelled by what you're saying, and they might be a little nervous, but they're like, all right, I'm going to try to do this. But I bet they're thinking, is my kid, now that they haven't grown up like this, maybe they're already 13, 14, are they really going to buy into this? Do they have the skills even at that point to try this? Do you think that for some people this might just be too far down the road, or you think they can just, the change?
Are we talking about play, or are we talking about letting them do
something? We're talking about independence. We're talking about like some, if they've been so sheltered.
You want to give them independence as they get older, right?
They've been sheltered to the point
that it's too late.
They built that skill. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that there's a human longing for, what do they say? People want autonomy, competence, and relatedness. Autonomy is a big drive. And, you know, if it's too late, then are you never going to give them any independence? Are you going to wait till they're 30? I mean, it doesn't make sense. It is incumbent upon us parents to teach our kids some of these skills that they'll need in the real world. I think a lot of them they will learn as they encounter the world, but teach them to cross the street safely, for God's sake. Teach them that they can talk to anyone. They cannot go off with anyone. That strangers are fine. Just don't go off with them. Don't get in a car with anybody. I mean, I think you teach them the basics. And then, you know, kids not only long for this autonomy, they want to do something significant. And if that's getting you the ingredients for dinner instead of just having dinner given to them, I mean, think about how much better, think about like my husband making his food or like when you sew, you probably don't sew something, but when you've made something yourself, an IKEA chair, which only took you 3.5 days, you feel so proud of it. You love it. You think it's the most beautiful thing because you did it. You know, I just did a TED talk. And the whole point is that saying I did it myself is like, it's like rocket fuel for everything in kids, for their competence, for their excitement, for their feeling of who they are. And to keep saying, I did it with my mom's help, or I did it with dad watching, it's a little different.
Yeah. Let me bring in some callers. We got some good ones lined up here. Okay. Let's start with Sherry from Hopewell, New Jersey, who's on line three. And this is an interesting dilemma I think Sherry's going to lay out here. Hey, Sherry, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I love that we're having this conversation. I grew up, you know, like most kids in the 80s, where I was forced outside after breakfast right. and didn't come home until dinner time. And I'm trying to raise my kids that way. They're 9 and 12. And I'll say to them, why aren't you guys outside more? And just like your survey, they say, we would love to be outside playing with our friends. And I kick them out. They go outside. But there's no kids. All their right. friends are yeah. home right. on their phones. And so it's right. like, you know, trying it's, to
how do you create the momentum? How do you create the momentum mm-hmm. in a society where it seems like the momentum doesn't exist? I want to build off what Sherry yeah. just said and read this comment from Cadence, who says, the only thing that gets my kids off their devices when they get home from school is when the neighborhood kids come knocking, asking them yes. to come play outside, which I'm yes, very lucky. Yes. This is the dynamic on my street. We are lucky enough to live on a small city street, put the orange cone up, let the kids play in the street. And I'm lucky so to live beautiful. On one of those blocks. But Sherry sounds like is not lucky enough to live in a neighborhood where this is part of really the culture of the parenting. So if you're in that situation, how do you get it going on like a neighborhood yeah. level?
Okay, let's dive in. First of all, I'd say still keep the schools open for free play so your kids would have a place where there are other kids who also don't have a scheduled activity or a phone in their hands are ready to play. So that's just sort of a simple one, but that doesn't address if you want your kids in your neighborhood to be playing. So there's a couple of ideas that we recommend. One is Free Play Fridays. And I have a blog post that I keep forgetting to put up about a 12-year-old who organized his own Free Play Friday. He put little postcards in the mailboxes of like 60 people, 60 mailboxes in his neighborhood saying, I'm going to be at, you know, Locust Valley Park at, you know, from 3 to 5 this Friday afternoon. Join me if you want. No parents welcome or something like that.
I've been thinking of the treehouse. No parents allowed, you know.
Yeah, right. And girls keep out. But what happened is that 20 kids showed up.
Yeah.
Because other kids want this too. And Peter Gray, who I work with, always says it's not nature. It's not the street that pulls kids out. It's other kids. So another idea somebody once wrote to our blog was she called it a friendship club. And what she did is she organized with three or four other families in the neighborhood, walking, biking distance, a sort of pact that like, look, my kid can knock on your doors, your kids can knock on our door. And if our kid isn't busy, we don't think it's an imposition for them to say, can you come out and play? Or can I come in and play? And so that way you've sort of renormalized what we've been talking about as our childhood, which was, can Betsy come out and play? Can Joel yeah. come out and play? And then you'd start roaming around. So that's a sort of easy thing to do. And then there's something called the Balance Project, which is started in New Jersey by a mom named Holly. And she's trying to create communities or neighborhoods where the parents come together and say, look, we want kids outside. Mm-hmm. We want to hear their voices. We want them to go to the parks. And so they sort of normalize it by saying, we are going to encourage our children to be outside, and we are going to encourage businesses. Businesses can put a little note in the window, you know, kids are welcome here. We don't think of you as all just, you know, shoplifters and hooligans, or where is your mom? So and then the other Let Grow. So aside from the play club that Let Grow recommends, we also recommend something that's free. It's called the Let Grow Experience. And that's where a school gives kids the homework assignment to go home and do something new on your own, with your parents' permission, but without your parents. You do this once a month. And we give a giant list of things kids can do, but it's an endless list. You can walk the dog, you can go to the store, you can climb a tree, you can make pancakes. And that at least renormalizes kids out and about in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And certainly makes it more likely that A kid would see another kid, or B, that adults seeing kids don't think that's so strange. Where's their mom? It's like, yeah. Oh, they're doing a Let Grow experience.
Let's take another caller. Line two, Jessica from Philadelphia, I think is going to speak to some of the insights that you've had about the detriment to not giving kids freedom. Hey, Jessica.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And I'm very thrilled to hear this discussion, because I think that parents, once they really understand the opportunities for growth for their children, when they are allowed some healthy amount of risk, that I think parents would really embrace it. We tend to think of risk, and we think of what could happen badly for children. But I want parents to think about what opportunities children miss when they are not exposed to a healthy amount of risk. And really, those are very important. They will miss. They'll miss opportunities for problem solving, for wonder, for awe. And they'll really miss out on learning how to gauge risk incrementally. And that becomes very dangerous later in life. Research has shown that children who are not exposed to, you know, healthy risk at a younger age don't have the capacity to really identify risk appropriately for themselves later.
Thank you for that
Jessica. You're welcome. Thank you.
I just like
flipping the perspective on risk. That's interesting.
You to respond, Lenore, like do we see real data so far in how this has played out in affecting society at large and culture at large?
Yeah, we have. Jessica might be referring to some research that's being done at Georgetown by a woman named, a professor named Yulia Chentsova. And she came from Russia, as you might guess by her name. And she had a very different childhood than she's seeing here. And so she started to study the ages between, I think, 5 and 12 or 7 and 12, I can't actually remember, are years when kids would normally be doing a lot on their own with other kids. I mean, in most of human history, there was a group of kids, they weren't segregated by age. The littlest ones would run after the bigger ones and kids would just do stuff together. They would copy the adults and they would go off and play. Anyways, she's seeing kids doing so little on their own that she worried that those years when they should be sort of every day calibrating their riskometer with, oh, that was scary, I won't do that again. Oh, that was scary, but kind of fun, I can climb a little higher. They're not getting a chance to do that calibration. As a result, they are pinging at 11 at everything because everything seems too dangerous and too risky. And the study that she did looked at, asked college students in Russia and Turkey versus college students in America and Canada to describe, just tell us a risky situation. And the ones in Russia were saying, like, you know, some drunk guy is coming after me with a broken vodka bottle on an icy street in Siberia. And the American kids were saying, like, sitting alone at Starbucks or taking an Uber. So you don't want kids to get this very off sense that very everyday-ish normal things are too hard or too scary for them. You know, that's not a dynamic culture.
So just, you said 5 to 12 there. Before we wrap up this conversation, is that a 5 about the age where we want to start fostering this type of independence? Because, like, I got a 2-year-old. And so, you know, I wasn't quite sure, am I part of this conversation yet? Or if I am, in what way? Like, what ages are we talking about where, like, we really, as parents, have to let go a little bit?
Well, I'll tell you, there's another cool book called, it's not Eat, Pray, Love, but it's Hunt, Gather, Parent. And that was another NPR reporter whose kid was driving her crazy and hitting her across the face at age 3. And so she schlepped the kid to indigenous cultures in, I think, Guatemala, Alaska, and someplace in Africa. And what she found, she found a lot, but the only thing I remember that she found is that from age about 2 to 4, kids are desperate to help out. They really want to, you know, help you set the table or I clean or whatever. Oh, and it's a drag because when they're cleaning, they're breaking everything and they leave, you know, snot. Things don't get cleaner. It doesn't make things easier for you. But you don't want that desire to extinguish.
Yeah.
And so you let them keep helping. So I'd say at age 2, you can have them be helping out. Age 5, Peter Gray says by age 5, kids can internalize a lot of rules and have some, you know, common sense. And obviously that just keeps going up from there. Right now, Pennsylvania is about to vote on a law. It doesn't have age limits on it, but it's a law that's called the Reasonable Childhood Independence Law. It's been passed in 11 states so far. And it says that, you know, neglect is not just letting your kid play outside or walk to school or walk home from the bus stop. Neglect is when you put your kid in obvious and serious danger. And it defers to the parent to make a decision when they think their kid is ready to do any of these things. And unless they're putting their kid in obvious and serious danger, that won't be considered neglect. So I'd love to see it passed in Pennsylvania because that would give parents the reassurance that they don't have to second guess their choices when they think their kid, age 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, whenever they think their kid is ready for a little more independence, they're allowed to give it to them.
One more thing before we let you go, Lenore, just practically speaking, you know, again, there might be some parents being convinced by what you're saying, and they're thinking the compromise is, well, make sure my kid has a smartphone or a smartwatch. Do you think that's a good compromise, or is that another layer here that you think should be looked at with scrutiny?
Well, I brought along something that I thought is a quite the artifact of this era. So this is a Skechers shoe, right?
You can see it,
I'm sure. Okay, and then if you lift up the insole on this, one second. I don't know if you can see there, but there's a little section. That's where you put in the AirTag. That to me is disturbing because it implies that a kid walking around without an AirTag is somehow endangered. Right? That this is just good common sense. I mean, Skechers is selling these, not not on Etsy, right? So to me, I think that you can trust your kids without tracking them. But I live in the real world and it's 2025. And I recognize that a lot of parents feel like they can't do that. Mm. So if that's what it takes to let your kid walk to school or take the bus or go to the mall, okay.
Yeah. So maybe some wiggle room there. When it comes to that parental surveillance. Lenore Skenazy.
I mean, we could do a whole nother thing
about
parental surveillance. But there you have it.
Oh, yeah. Maybe give them all beepers. We're talking about winding back the clock, right? Lenore Skenazy is president of Let Grow and author of Free Range Kids. And it was a pleasure to have on the show today. Thank you so much for your time, Lenore.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with the drive.
Thanks.
Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Adam Staniszewski and Tina Kalake engineered today's show. My name is Kevin McCrory. I'm the executive producer of the show, and this is...
Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.